Each of us has a unique career story to tell. For some, these fly high like rocket launches. For others, they're more like the game of chutes and ladders, with advances and setbacks along the way. Either way, we learn countless lessons from these experiences. And that's what we put into the spotlight here at Career Sessions Career Lessons. Join discussions featuring a variety of guests sharing their stories of ups and downs, as well as the secrets of their success and what drives them to continue moving forward. We break down the tools and resources that will help you establish your dream career and realize your professional goals. Here's your host, J.R. Lowry.
Hi, I'm J.R. Lowry, and this is Career Sessions Career Lessons, which is brought to you by Pathwise.io. Pathwise is dedicated to helping you be the best professional you can be, providing a mix of career and leadership coaching, courses, content, and community. Basic membership is free, so visit Pathwise and join today. Today, my guest is Amy Gallo. Amy is a workplace expert who writes and speaks about gender, interpersonal dynamics, difficult conversations, feedback, and effective communication. She works with individuals, teams, and organizations around the world to help them collaborate, improve how they communicate, and transform the organizational culture to support dissent and debate. She is the best-selling author of Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People, and the HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict, a how-to book about handling conflict professionally and productively. She has also written hundreds of articles for Harvard Business Review, where she is a contributing editor. And for the past 4 years, she has co-hosted HBR's popular Women at Work podcast, which examines the struggles and successes of women in the workplace. Amy has taught at Brown University and the University of Pennsylvania, and is a graduate of both Brown and Yale University. Amy, welcome, and thanks so much for doing the show with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, JR.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with the mix of things you're doing today. Give our audience an overview of what you're up to.
Yeah, it's shifting, actually. It's interesting. I used to always say I had three things that I focused on. One is a lot of work that I do with Harvard Business Review, originally as an editor, but now more as an author and producing content like video and co-hosting our Women at Work podcast. So that's one big chunk. I still do a lot of that. The second is speaking workshops based on my two books, The HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict and Getting Along. And then the third was a leadership coaching practice, but I've really stopped coaching as much. And partly because the speaking and the books have really taken a bigger chunk of my time.
Yeah, I mean, coaching, it gives you sort of that one-on-one interaction with people where you have a very much a kind of on-the-ground view as to what people are thinking about and worrying about in the work world, but it doesn't scale very well.
Yeah, and I enjoy it. I actually have always really appreciated my coaching clients for exactly the reason you said. Like, I got a really insider's view of what leaders are struggling with. But I'm seeing more of that. Actually, I do a lot of talks with leadership teams. So I still get that sort of inside view, which is really helpful. And I just, unfortunately, just don't have the time for coaching like I did before.
I mean, even so, I mean, the speaking, the writing, the workshops, the podcast, the other things that you're doing, it's a lot. How do you balance your time?
I don't. Whenever I call to make a doctor's appointment and they're like, what's generally good for you, morning or afternoon? What days of the week? I always say every week is a new hot mess. So I don't know. Yeah. The truth is, I actually was in the fortunate position of taking a big chunk of time off this summer. I took 3 months off. And one of the biggest takeaways from that time was that life was still really busy, even after I removed work. And I think for me, it's not about balancing as much as like really trying to plan for the year. What am I most excited about? What am I prioritizing? And then making good choices about what's going to be the most important thing, what's the second most important thing. And then, of course, it's a game of whack-a-mole and trying to sort it out. I'm also very fortunate that I have a really great team that works with me that really helps me. This is relatively new in the last 2 years that just really helps me keep all the balls in the air, basically.
Did you do anything special during your time off last summer?
I did. So I took June through August off. The first month, we did a big family trip to Mozambique. I have a middle school friend who lives there with her family. So two other friends of ours and my family, was 15 of us total, 8 adults and 7 teenagers. We were in Mozambique for 2 weeks. It was an amazing sort of once in a lifetime trip. It was great. And then I spent the rest of the time, my goal was to produce nothing. I didn't want to produce a podcast, write an article, do any interviews. I just wanted to take things in. So I read 15 books, and that was like 15 novels. And that was just a pleasure.
Yeah. And if you're used to reading a lot of nonfiction, when you step back and give yourself time to read a novel, it is such a guilty pleasure, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and I remember saying to my husband at one point, he's like, oh, you're not reading any business books. And I was like, these are business books. Like, this is about developing empathy. I'm looking at conflicts between characters, right? I'm an author of business books. I think of them as the things that are going to help people the most. And I'm really a big believer that fiction and studying human dynamics and human relationships is just as helpful, if not more important for leaders.
I usually go back and forth. Lately, I've been reading more business books, and especially as I've been doing these interviews and people have written books, and I generally get through the books before the interviews. Some of them, I still have a little bit of a, oh, I have to read 20 more pages of this one or 50 more pages of that one. So at some point, I'll get a break and we'll get to get caught up on them. But I don't read as many novels as I used to, and I wish I'd made more time for it. So,
yeah. Well, I have a little trick. I don't know if you would enjoy this, but I have a teenage daughter who's very into graphic novels and young adult fiction. And because they're so short and quick, sometimes I'll just pick up something that she loved and read it, because it's still, I get that fiction boost, but it's not a 400 page novel. And sometimes even just reading one, I'm actually reading one now. And sometimes that actually gets me in the sort of mindset to read longer fiction.
Yeah, it's good. You mentioned a minute ago that you sort of think about the year and what you want to get done. So what are your priorities for this year as we're coming into the year?
So a couple of things. I'm really focused on speaking. I've got a lot of great speaking gigs coming up. I'm traveling to LA, Aruba. I'm doing a talk at an innovation summit in Aruba, which I'm excited about. I've got Bogota and Mexico City later in the year. I'm really thinking about how to expand the industries and the audiences and the locations where I speak. So that's a big focus for me, as well as thinking about my next book. I'm not ready to talk about it, but it's on the horizon and really very much connected to getting along my latest book. Yeah. But that's also a big priority for me as well this year.
So let's talk about Getting Along. Came out in 2022. What was the impetus for the book and what's its overall message?
I wrote The HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict, and I started doing talks and workshops based on that. And it's really meant to be like a straightforward, practical approach to conflict. And I was getting great feedback in these workshops and talks. But what would inevitably happen is someone would come up to me afterwards, whether it's in the elevator or maybe during the Q&A session, or sometimes it was virtual, like they'd find me in the chat. They would say, this is great. This is super helpful. But I have this one coworker. And then they would describe someone who, like, a lot of the general advice just really didn't work with. And that was like, I started thinking, like, okay, how do I help these people? And there were patterns of the type of behavior they would describe, a lot of passive aggressive behavior, a lot of insecurity. And so in my role as an editor at HBR, I was also exposed to a ton of research that academics are doing about these patterns of behavior and how to deal with them. So I thought, okay, can I take that research that exists and translate that into practical advice for people who are dealing with people who fit into one of these archetypes? And that's essentially how I structured the book. The book is 8 different archetypes of quote unquote difficult people. And we can talk about those air quotes around difficult if you want. But the things like the insecure manager, the biased colleague, the political operator, passive aggressive peer, the know-it-all. And each chapter really delves into what explains that behavior, right? What would be a rational explanation for why someone would exhibit that behavior? What tactics you can use, including sample language, to try to transform the relationship? They're not going to become your BFF, right? But transform the relationship so that it's less stressful for you. And sometimes that's about setting boundaries. Sometimes that's about nudging them into more productive behavior. But really, it's just about trying to find. Sometimes people ask, like, what problem does this book solve? And I always think sleepless nights, right? Like, it solves what I hope it solves is that moment where you wake up at 3 in the morning and you're like, why am I thinking about John from finance? Like, right? Yeah. I want to help people just feel less stress, even though our interactions at work aren't always perfect.
And as you say, I mean, people come up to you and say, I have this coworker. I mean, you cite right at the beginning of the book, we've all had these coworkers, right? And 94% of people say they've worked with a toxic person in the last 5 years, 87% say team culture was affected. A third of people have moved jobs because of a coworker. I mean, it is kind of an epidemic in a way.
Oh, for sure. When I say the title and subtitle of my book to anyone, I can be in the dentist chair talking to the hygienist. I can be talking to the train conductor when I'm on the Amtrak to New York. It doesn't matter. If the name of the book comes up, Getting Along, How to Deal with Difficult People, the response is always, I need that book. They're not all buying it, fair enough. But I think that what it really shows is that it is a universal problem. And it makes sense. Like, humans are messy. We're not perfect. And I think very rarely are we taught about how to deal with conflicts. And so these coworkers who were really pushing our buttons, exhibiting like sometimes really problematic behavior, we don't have the skills to address it or to set boundaries around it or to try to, as I said, sort of nudge them into more productive behavior. Yeah. And we don't have a choice often. Like, you don't get to choose your coworkers, right? Sometimes you do, but
and not everybody can just say, oh, I quit.
Exactly. Nor do they want to. I was talking to someone just last week who was describing the situation, which honestly, if I could have just been like completely sort of blunt, I would have just said, quit, please quit right now. Get out. This sounds terrible. We got there eventually, but like, can you? And she kept saying, I don't want to quit. I love my job. It's just this one person. And so then we sort of started to strategize. Okay. So if you love your job, how do you sort of right-size this relationship so it's not impacting everything else? And how do you deal with the most troublesome behavior that this person is exhibiting?
And a lot of people, as you say, I mean, it's a lot of people struggle with how to deal with these situations. Many people avoid conflict. You know that. You write about conflict. Also, I mean, it starts to trigger the irrational part of your brain, right? And you start to have that sort of flight or fight kind of response. And a lot of this is about kind of getting your rational brain to take over, put these different situations in perspective. Obviously, you wouldn't want them in the first place, but some of it's just, it's coping, right? It's just teaching yourself how to cope and maybe shift the narrative, if you will.
I love the way you said that, JR, because I think a lot of the advice I share in my articles and the books as well, it's sort of about appealing to your better self, because as you said, we get stressed when we're in these moments or in these relationships or in these interactions. And then we do things like later, we're like, why did I do that? Or, oh God, that's not what I meant to say, or but that made things worse. And so I think it's really about how do we develop the tools to appeal to our best self, because being our best self in the moment, even when that person is being a complete jerk, right, does help us feel good about how we behave, but also helps nudge that behavior, nudge that relationship into sort of more productive territory.
We won't go through all eight of them. I'm curious. I've worked with all eight of them. Have you? How many of them have you worked with?
All of them. Sometimes people will ask me, what's your favorite? I'm like, are you kidding? Like, they're all my least favorite. And I will say, not only have I worked with all eight of them, well, actually, have I? Yes, I was going to say the tormentor is a really hard one, but I have worked with a tormentor. I've also been all of them. And that's, I think, an important part to realize of, like, especially like the know-it-all. I'm the know-it-all all the time, right? I've been passive aggressive. I've taken my insecurity about things out on other people, right? I've been the biased colleague. I think that's one of the things it's important to realize is, like, no one is above this behavior. These people just aren't like flawed human. Well, they are flawed humans because we're all flawed humans, but they're not evil typically. They're just people who, for whatever reason, can't find that better self in themselves and then exhibit these behaviors.
I won't call them favorites, even though that word was in my notes, but I'll ask you instead, pick one that you want to talk about just in terms of, practically speaking, what's the manifestation and how should somebody deal with that kind of person?
Sure. So I'll choose the know-it-all, not because it's my favorite, but because it's the one I relate. Like, I wrote that chapter in the book through like cringing the entire time because I relate so much to being the know-it-all. I've gotten feedback in the past about having a condescending tone or declaring things with 100% certainty when I only know it to be like 15% certain. So I really relate to it. And I think it's one that people encounter a lot in part. And what explains the behavior is that we love overconfidence. We reward overconfidence, especially inside organizations, because oftentimes people are doing things that are hard to measure, like lead or manage, right? And so instead of relying on measurement, because there isn't a measurement we can rely on, we rely on their word. How good are they at? And we are all overconfident, right? One of my favorite statistics, and this is in the book, is when you ask people if they're a better than average driver, it's like 75 to 78% of people will say yes, which obviously is a statistical impossibility, right? 78% people cannot be above average, right? So our tendency to be overconfident, we tend to reward it. And I think a lot of people have gotten far in their careers by declaring things they know for certain when they're not exactly certain. So those are the behaviors. They tend to interrupt a lot. They tend to talk over people. They have just supreme confidence about things that they shouldn't necessarily be confident about. When we think about gender, it often comes into mansplaining, right? Telling someone something that they already know, but explaining it in a condescending tone. So that's sort of the description of the person.
And how do you cope that chapter of the book? What does that chapter of the book talk about in terms of how you would work with those people more constructively?
Before I get to the tactics, one of the things, each chapter includes some questions to ask yourself. And I do think I'll just share one of those questions for the know-it-all, because I think it's important, which is one of the things you have to do is interrogate your own bias when it comes to dealing with anyone who you find difficult. And sometimes someone is actually confident or competent, but we don't allow them to be, perhaps because of their gender or their racial identity or their position or age in the organization. So we will often say, oh, they're a know-it-all, even when they're actually just behaving the same way everyone else is. We just don't want them to sort of own that expertise or that confidence. So that's a question you want to ask yourself. Once you've sort of interrogated that, yeah, chances are that person's still behavior is problematic. And a couple sort of quick tips I'll share. One is to ask for facts and data. Because like I said, one of the things that they do is to declare things as definitive, right? That product will absolutely fail. Our clients will hate this new initiative, right? And they just seem so certain. And so one of the things you can do is ask them, do you have facts or evidence to back that up? Or could we run a quick experiment to be sure that perspective is true? Not that you're sort of, you don't want to get into a I'm right, you're wrong struggle, but just sort of inquiring. And they may say, oh no, I don't need the facts, right? I know it to be true. But what you've done is you've put them on notice that you're not going to just let them get away with declaring something. You're going to inquire about whether they've got some evidence to back that up. One of the other things, the big ones, one of the things they broker in is interruptions, right? Is people will start talking and they presume they already know the answer. So they just start talking. You can often preempt those by even saying, if you're dealing with someone who tends to interrupt a lot and know it all, you might say, interruptions really break my train of thought. Can you just hold any questions or comments you have to the end? I'll make sure to get to you, right? Just sort of preempt that. If they still interrupt, you can also enlist. It can be awkward and also difficult to say, please don't interrupt me. Although if that's available to you, you feel comfortable doing it by all means, but you can also enlist allies. So if you and I were in a meeting with a know-it-all, I might say, hey, JR, this colleague of ours often interrupts when I'm in the middle of my comment. Would you mind just saying, let's let Amy finish, right? And just sort of enlisting. And sometimes I might not even have to do that with you because you already notice what's going on. And so you would step in and be like, I still want to hear the end of Amy's thought. Could we do that before you start talking? And so just trying to sort of address the behavior. With any of these archetypes, you also have the option, if you're comfortable, if you think it will be effective, to sort of have a meta conversation with someone where you give them feedback and you say, you've interrupted me like three times in that last meeting, or I get the sense that we don't know as much as you, or we're not as expert in this area as you. Is that true? Right? Just to sort of have a feedback conversation in which you can share the experience of what it's like to be on the receiving end of that behavior and sort of encourage them to change that so that it doesn't have that negative impact. Not always effective. Sometimes you're going to get like a real strong reaction to that. But I think it's always available to you to be a little bit more direct as well.
So there's eight chapters like that that cover the different archetypes. You also talk about what not to do.
Yeah. And I think that's one of my favorite chapters because I think there's things we tend to do. I'll just name a couple. One is like to retaliate, right? Hmm. So like I see this all the time. And I have a family member who I will not name because if they hear this, they'll be very upset for that I'm calling them out for this. But they'll tell me about this terrible person they work with. And they're like, so I'm just going to give it back. And I'm like, do you think that's good? going to work, right? Like you just start to escalate the situation if you do that. And so I think you really need to think about, one, you need to be proud of your behavior at the end of the day. Like that's the thing that's going to allow you to sleep at night. And if you're just sort of beating back the same exact, pardon the language, but crap that they're giving you, are you really going to feel good about that? So you really want to watch out for retaliating, especially if the person is in a position of power, because that's the more you sort of feed into that escalation, the more likely they might actually do something that could hurt your career or your position in the organization. Right. Another one is, and I was just talking about this earlier, actually, with a colleague who was saying, like, we're talking about sort of having a positive outlook when things are really stressful. And we were talking about how there's a thin line between sort of trying to have a positive outlook and then like suppressing your emotions. And I think that's another thing that people try to do is like pretend it doesn't bother. Like, oh, that's just JR. Oh, that's just Amy. Right. And I think it's, you want to feel the emotions it brings up. Like you don't want to suppress them. We know all of the harmful things that happen when we suppress emotions. It's really bad for us physiologically and psychologically. So you want to actually be like, okay, this person makes me mad. I find this situation really frustrated. I'm really disappointed. I have a coworker like this. And then you can sort of decide what to do and take action. You want to have agency, but you don't want to pretend that you're not at all triggered or upset by the behavior, because it's just not going to be helpful to you.
Yeah. But as you said, and you said it's at the beginning, you know, what problem is the book solving? And you said sleepless nights. Yeah. I mean, all of this, it takes a big toll on you physically, emotionally, mentally. I know you have a chapter in the book that talks about how to protect yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And it'd be, maybe we could go in a little bit into that as well.
Yeah. And I think you're right. It does take a toll. And I think you want to be careful that you're not putting so much effort into this one relationship that it's hurting other aspects of your career or your work or your life. And I think that's one of the biggest things that people can do to protect themselves is to remember this is just one person, right? It might be two people, it might be three people, but you probably have coworkers you really enjoy working with. Spend more time with them. Spend more time thinking. And I even do this exercise. If I wake up in the middle of the night worried about a relationship with someone or thinking about someone, I'm like, no, let me think about someone I actually love spending time with, my daughter, a different coworker, a friend from college, right? And just right-sizing that person's impact on your life, I think it can be really important. And that's sort of a one tactic in this sort of bigger category of setting boundaries, right? So you might often, there's this concept called job crafting. Amy Wisniewski at Yale writes about this a lot, is that you want to adjust your job. So you're focused on the things that are enjoyable to you. Of course, there's some things you just have to do, but if you can sculpt your job in a way that you don't have to interact with that person as much, right? That, so maybe you focus on other projects. Maybe you decide that you don't need that weekly meeting about the project that they're involved with. You can turn it into an email update. Maybe there's someone else on your team who can take over who doesn't find that person as frustrating as you do. Just sort of trying to put space between you and that interaction. And then, of course, I'm a huge fan of mantras, right? Trying to remind yourself, this isn't about me. Just because I can't improve this relationship or I can't make it better doesn't mean that I'm weak, right? This is really probably about them. One of my favorite things to remind myself, and it's not the nicest thing, but it really helps, which is like every day I wake up as me and I'm really glad I wake up as me, and that person has to wake up as their miserable self. And I'm just so glad I don't have to do that, right? It's just trying to sort of create distance between you and the other person. And I used to say a lot, especially coming out of the first book around conflict, is like, I encourage people to have empathy, like put yourself in the other person's shoes, think about their struggles. I do think that's a really useful tactic, but I don't think you should do it at the expense of empathy for yourself. Like you really have to have self-compassion, right? Yeah. These things aren't just hard for you. They're hard for everyone. Talk to yourself in a nice way about it. Remind yourself that you didn't choose this. And if you did, you would have chosen something different. You really just have to be nice to yourself along the way.
Very true. I'm curious. I know you wrote the book 2 years ago. Yeah. Hard to imagine completely, but if you went back and thought about if you'd written it 20 years ago, do you think the 8 archetypes would be similar or different?
Oh, that is such a good question. Even in the time when I was writing the book, a couple things shifted. So I think actually they would have been really different. Although it's funny, some of them, I'm sure the know-it-all, like, there have been know-it-alls since the beginning of time. There will be know-it-alls till the end of time. I probably wouldn't have written about the bias colleague because workplaces were not nearly as diverse and we just didn't have the sort of general awareness we do. I'm sure there were political operators, especially when I think about like flatter organizations with less hierarchy. There's probably a lot jockeying for position that happens. I think the insecure manager may not have been as prescient because we were in thinking about more hierarchical organizations. I do think the behaviors are sort of timeless, but how we think about them are different. And the shift I was alluding to earlier, like when I first started conceiving of the book, I did a couple LinkedIn surveys of people just to ask, what are the patterns of behavior? Which of the archetypes resonate? And it was interesting. A lot of the comments I got back were, no one can be called difficult. There's only difficult behaviors, not difficult people. And I think that's really good feedback. And I think it's something I agree with. But as I was starting to promote the book, what was interesting is a lot of people took issue with that of like, no, some people are toxic and some people, their behavior needs to be remedied or they need to be told exactly what they think. I think there was just a lot less patience with people in that sort of shift in the last, it was like 2 to 3 years. At least that's what I observed in just the reaction to the book.
Do you think organizations are getting better at dealing with their difficult people or difficult behaviors?
You know, I so wish the answer was yes. I'm actually curious what you think, because I know you do, you work with a lot of organizations too, but in some ways I think there's, I don't know. I want the answer to be yes, but I'm not sure that's true. I think we've actually, in some ways, the pendulum swings back and forth of like, fire people quickly if their behavior is problematic or they're not fitting or they're not succeeding, to like, it's too dangerous, too many lawsuits. Like, it's just, I think it really depends on the organization. I think universally, we're pretty bad at giving people honest feedback that's actionable that they can do something about. But I don't know, what's your experience? Do you feel like organizations are getting better?
I think they are, to be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, if I think about my own work experience, I mean, some of the things that used to happen, I mean, the boys club and the people who would just say the most ridiculous racist things that would get you fired in a heartbeat today, they were more tolerated, and tolerated probably requires air quotes, but more tolerated back. And I think organizations are getting better. I still see in my own experience, there are times where the acid test is always like, how's HR going to respond to this situation, right? And the leadership team. And there are times where they respond and they respond appropriately. And then there are other times where they're like, oh, but he's our best salesperson, right? Or he's so good at his job and or she's so good at her job. And they sort of let performance trump bad behavior. Yeah, I still think that occurs a lot. There's a sort of justification of, oh, you know, Bob's just being Bob, just ignore him, because they don't want to deal with the situation, right? Apart from the lawsuit, just the difficulty of having to go through whatever process. But I do think there are a lot of behaviors that used to be put up with at work that I don't think are put up with anymore. It's an ongoing thing, right? I mean, people are and always will be messy until the computers take over for us, you know?
Right. Although, and I think you're point is a good one about sort of the overt biased behavior. I do think is like the overt is typically not tolerated, as you said, and often addressed. The problem is I think now a lot of it is sort of this implicit bias or microaggressions. And I don't think most companies are good at handling how those behaviors impact people or even acknowledging that those behaviors impact people.
And obviously there's all sorts of, I mean, they're called microaggressions for a reason, right? I mean, they're very often very subtle. One of the most powerful things, one of the companies I've worked for did it, had a video on workplace bias, and it had this, basically did the exact same script with two different ways, right? One way was very obvious. There was microaggression all over the place. Same words coming from the same people said in a different way or with different body language. And it was really amazing. It was very clever how they did it to be able to show that it's not always even what you say, it's how you say it, it's your body language when you're saying it that will convey something very different, which shouldn't surprise us since 90-odd% of what we communicate is not through our words, it's through body language and tone and other things. And at the same time, it was really interesting to see how you could take the exact same situation and make it look completely different. even with the same words.
And I think that's really important to keep in mind, because it's like the same words, but it's often even about different tone of voice or different body language, but it's often even the identity. Like, that's one of the things I really wanted to pay attention to in the book. And I think often is missing from these discussions around difficult behaviors or difficult interactions, which is that the way we interpret someone's behavior is going to be through a lens of bias. So you and I saying the exact same thing because we're different genders might be interpreted in totally different ways. And someone right. might find you difficult for saying that and me easy to work with, or vice versa. And so I think—
Or vice versa, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's why I really wanted to pay attention to issues of bias and identity in the book, because I think oftentimes that's a layer we don't think about when it comes yeah. to challenging interactions.
Yeah, probably a good segue into, I know you focus a lot on the challenges that women face in the workplace. You host HBR's Women at Work podcast. At the risk of answering maybe an obvious question, what are the biggest issues that women are facing in the workplace right now?
Oh boy. Well, I will first say that podcast is one of my favorite projects to work on. I love the team that works on that project. I love the experts that we have on the show. It's just such a fun thing to work on. And to be able to talk about and hear from so many women about what they are struggling with is just a privilege. But to answer your question, gosh, it's so many things and it's so different. I do think one of the big ones is about intersectionalities. The research on gender and gender bias in particular in the workplace is almost universally on white women. So we're really trying to sort of now understand a little bit more about the layering effect when a woman has a disability, is a person of color, right? And how that those biases compound and interact with one another. I think that's a really big one that a lot of women are struggling with, is trying to understand, how are they being perceived or interpreted? How are they being promoted or not promoted based on some of those biases? Right. One of the things we hear over and over is just also stepping into leadership and being taken seriously, thinking about how you communicate, your executive presence, your ability to persuade and influence people. That's a big one we hear about too. Just how do you get taken seriously as a leader when you're a woman, and when almost all the research shows that most of us equate the idea of a leader with a white man. And so when you're stepping into a role where maybe you're not expected to be, how do you do that in a way that can be as effective as possible? I think the other thing is, a lot of what I hear about is working also in male-dominated fields, and how, as a woman, do you find your place? How do you address bias when it comes up? Again, how do you get taken seriously? Gosh, I could go on and on. Feedback is another one. How do you interpret feedback that you get? How do you listen to what's useful, dismiss what might be a little bit biased or unfounded? And then how do you sort of take action on what you want to take action on? I mean, and then there's bigger issues too, like pay gaps. We have no dearth of topics to address in that podcast for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, apart from the sort of topic specific advice, it's an imperfect world, right? You can make yourself crazy wanting the world to be perfect. How do you counsel people to kind of balance the fighting for change, but also having some acceptance of the fact that it's not going to happen overnight?
So the last episode we did for this past season, which just ended in December, it was our season 9. It's called titled Sexism is Everywhere. It's something I've been wanting to do for a while, because we do educate people about a lot of the gender bias, about sexism, what you're going to encounter in the workplace. But as you said, you can drive yourself mad thinking about, well, was that because I'm a woman, or is that because I'm a woman of color, right? And so we brought two experts on who really helped us think through, what do you do with that information, right? Like, if you suspect you didn't get that promotion because of some gender bias, or the feedback you gave is being influenced by someone's sort of traditional values or viewpoints, like, what do you actually do with that? And there's no science to it, but I think one of the things we kept coming back to is, it's good to question whether that's actually happening, but it shouldn't necessarily be the loudest voice in your head, because you're not going to change centuries of patriarchy in your one interaction with your boss. And so really trying to remember, okay, what's my goal here? What is it I actually need to get done? What's the most effective way to do that? Is it to call out this bias, which might be the answer? Or is it to try to address the specific thing going on between us? Is it to enlist help, right? Or is it to address the specific thing and then take note, or even start working, especially one of the things we're really try to be cognizant of is that a lot of our listeners are in leadership positions. So they have the power or the authority to actually affect those systems. So how do you do both? How do you address the specific situation, tend to your goals, get what you need, set boundaries when you need to, and how do you sort of agitate to make sure that the systems are continually evolving? And one of the ways I do that is through the podcast, is really trying to raise these issues, trying to get us talking about what are we seeing out there? What do we experience? What does the research show about what women's experiences are like in the workplace? And how can we that lead to productive change? It's hard because sometimes I hear some of the gender bias, especially like when I think about like conflict and communication. One of the things we know from research is that women tend to be punished for being agentic. That's the sort of academic term, but maybe being assertive, advocating for ourselves. Right. So does that mean we shouldn't, right? Like you can get really paralyzed of like, well, if that's the research, do I advocate for myself or do I not? And I think it's helpful to know that that's the research, but then, okay, but what's the most effective thing to do in this situation? I think it's really the question I try to ask myself.
And what about for the men who want to be helpful on this topic?
Well, listen to the podcast. It was funny. I was talking to a couple the other day, a man and a woman, and she said, oh, you host this podcast. And he said, oh, you should listen to that, to his wife. And I turned to him, I said, no, you should listen to it. I do think trying to educate yourself just on what the experience of being a woman in your specific workplace is like can be really helpful. Being aware of the research around gender bias and just ultimately really trying to advocate. There's a lot of noise about like just trying to treat people equally. I think, of course, our goal, but you also have to remember when it comes to gender, like in most workplaces, women are having to work a little bit harder to reach the same levels. So like, how can you sort of try to level that playing field in whatever your purview is, right? You may not be a CEO, but like on your team, is there ways that you can run your meetings so they're more equitable? Are there new criteria you can put in place for promotions that make sure that everyone is getting equal chances at opportunities and bias isn't coming into play? Or hiring, right? Choose whatever something is in within your job description. How can you focus on that thing and try to make it as equitable as possible?
You do a lot of writing for the HBR. You were a contributing editor at one point, as you mentioned. What's your sense of what's going on in the world of work more broadly? What are the hot topics at the moment besides artificial intelligence?
You took my answer right away. I mean, it's AI. My work at HBR is really focused on this section of our content called You and Your Team. So it's really the practical interpersonal. How do you manage yourself? How do you manage your team? So that's one thing I'm really focused on. But in that world, and one of the things we're hearing about a ton, of course, is just the continued hybrid work, remote work, the struggle. Do people go back to office? Do not? What does the data actually say about whether you need to be or not? That's really an ongoing conversation. Conversations around DEI are also still really big. And just there was a lot of, especially in the wake of George Floyd's murder, there was a lot of discussion around like how the business case for DEI, why we need to do this. And I think we're now getting to the place where we're like, okay, but what works, right? Like how do we actually make sure we're doing things that are effective, that are not virtue signaling, that are not just a corporate initiative that gets forgotten in 6 months. So that's another topic that comes up a lot. I learn a lot from what gets submitted to HBR. I serve on one of our pitch teams around the You and Your Team content. So I get to see a lot of what authors and experts are thinking about and hearing about, as well as practitioners. We a lot of people who contribute to HBR leaders and in organizations. And so that I'm always curious what's on people's mind. A lot of people are thinking about hiring right now and retention as well, equitable hiring. I mean, I could list many, many more topics. Those are sort of the ones that come top of mind. I'm curious, what are you hearing as sort of the most pressing business topics in your work?
Well, certainly, I mean, some of the ones you mentioned, right? AI for sure. Diversity is always a topic. Remote work, hybrid work, the sort of the trade-off between, I'll say, the personal benefit for people who feel they're more individually productive at home versus the idea of collective productivity, right? Like, how do you train a new person how to do their job when there's not a place for them to learn? And that's a bit of that trade-off. The economy is always a factor in just dealing with, you know, I work in financial services, so volatility in the markets and the geopolitical conflict and how that's impacting the markets and affecting things like unemployment and inflation and all of those kinds of things are certainly very top of mind. I think in general, people are more students of what's going on in the work world, I think, than they used to be. You don't have to go to business school necessarily to really get that sort of grounding in things. And so I hear there's a lot more awareness around some of the things that you and others write about, right? That whereas, I mean, business books are relatively new genre in the scheme of things. And so as the thinking in academic and other circles has evolved, I think the business world is taking more and more of this in, and it just sort of in some ways accelerates learning for organizations. One of the other things that I see going on in the UK is there's a real thought of creating programs that essentially eliminate the need to go to university, to college. And so the idea is that you would come in as an apprentice straight out of high school. And after 3 or 4 years, you would have worked, whereas your peers, your contemporaries would have gone to college, but you're equal after that, right? Like you get yours through an on-the-job model. And that's a concept I don't hear people talking about as much here in the US, but I mean, if any place needs it, it's probably the US because college educations are so horribly expensive, I mean, way more expensive than they are in the UK. And so I'm really intrigued by seeing those programs take root and hoping they'll come to this side of the Atlantic because I think there's a lot of benefit. I mean, I think about my kids. One of them wants to be a researcher. She's working on her PhD. She needed to go to school. My son was doing pretty well doing coding work even before he went to school. Sure. And he might have been able to get by with not ever needing to go. I mean, he would have missed the social experience of it. But for a lot of families, the economic trade-off of, hey, you know, I know you want to go have 4 years of fun, but you trade that against what that fun costs. And it'll be interesting to see whether that comes across the pond. But it's definitely a big focus at the moment in London.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think the US is sort of obsessed with the college experience in a way that doesn't make rational sense anymore, given the cost, right? I'll be curious to see if that does translate over here. That would be great.
You're on a pitch committee. How does HBR select the things that it likes to publish?
Unfortunately, we, given the amount of submissions, we reject a lot. It's hard. And we reject a lot of good stuff just because we don't have the bandwidth to publish it all. But really, we're looking for, is this a new idea? Will this feel fresh to our audience? Is there evidence that backs up this idea? How practical and useful it is. We talk a lot about improving the practice of management. And so, you know, we ask ourselves, does this actually do that? And is it educating a leader in a new way? Is it giving them a new skill? Is it giving them a new perspective? When leaders aren't our primary audience, we talk to individual contributors. We have a whole vertical focused on people who are new to their careers as well. We have criteria we really look at, but then it's also those questions around, is this fresh? Is this new? And will this help?
What else do you read? What other publications out there?
Like most people, I don't sit down with a magazine or sit down at a website and read through. It's more about like what articles come across my social media feeds or someone sends to me in a text. But I'm often find myself reading a lot in The Atlantic, certainly the Economist, New York Times. I actually find a lot of like the work focused reels on Instagram so interesting. Like people, even the parodies, like I think you learn a lot about what's on people's minds and where thinking is going just from memes even. So I don't want to imply that I'm just sort of sitting down and reading magazines or just articles. And I'm sort of trying to take it all in as much as possible.
Well, it's, I mean, you get that immersion, right? You learn through doing enough immersion that you feel like you've kind of got a finger on the pulse of what people are thinking about. And it's important to me, especially I'm in my late 50s. The generational thing is also very big as a topic, right? We've got still baby boomers and I'm a Gen X and you've got the millennials and Gen Z. And those are four very different generations that are all working together. And getting all of them sort of in sync with each other is often a big focus of work conversation.
Yeah, I get asked about generational conflict a lot, about conflict between generations at work. And there is a line of research, Peter Capelli at Wharton, and there are a couple other researchers as well, who actually say the differences between the generations are not that big. It's really about age. So boomers, when they were 20, were just as entitled or self-focused as millennials when they were 20 or as Gen Zs are right now, right? And it's really just about stage of life and your values at that stage of life. I do also think when you grew up, like the world events, what was going on, what were political happenings, like that, of course, influences you, right? So I do think the generations have different life experiences that influence their values, influence their view on hierarchies and how we should interact at work and what's acceptable behavior and what's not. And so I do think there are differences, but I also try to remind myself, yeah, but that millennial who I'm frustrated with is just doing that because they're 35, not because they're a millennial, right? Like I did that when I was 35 too. So just trying to remember, as much as we have our differences, there's also similarities.
Last question, I guess, sort of related to age. If you could go back and give your younger self some career advice, what advice would it be?
Worry a lot less. It will all happen. It'll happen because you took action and you made things happen. But sometimes I picture myself sort of going through my career, gripping really tightly, like, is this the right choice? Is this going to be the right thing? What's next? And I just sort of wish I had relaxed a little bit more into it and trusted my gut of like, this feels good. Let's continue doing that. Oh, this doesn't feel good. Let's switch. And it's one of the things I do try of a teenage daughter who I really try to just say, because she's starting to think about college, you know, people are like, well, what do you want to stay? I'm like, no, like maybe she has interests, but those things are going to change and evolve. And I just think that I wish I could go back and tell my sort of 25-year-old self, like, trust me, good stuff is coming. Just sort of keep working hard, keep following what is interesting and follow people. I mean, I think that's the other thing. We really have this individual focus of a career of like, what do I want to do? What do I want to accomplish? And so much of what I've been able to achieve has been in collaboration with other people. So like surround yourself with like really interesting, awesome people and trust me, good career stuff will come from that.
Yeah. And then kind of let the wander happen.
Exactly. The wandering feels terrible because everyone wants to know exactly what you're doing next and what's your 5-year plan and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like quiet that noise. And just like you said, just wander.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you for doing this with me today.
Thank you. This has been a really fun conversation.
Yeah, we didn't get to workplace conflict. Maybe at some point we can come back and talk about the HBR Guide to Conflict, which you literally wrote. You wrote the book on conflict, so to speak. But I appreciate we covered a lot of ground today. So I obviously wanted to spend time on getting along since it's been so well received. So
yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, this was perfect. So thanks.
Yeah, good. All right. Well, have a good day.
Thank you. You too, JR.
I'd like to thank Amy for joining me today to discuss her work, her book, Getting Along, her thoughts on the challenges that women face in the workplace, and a little bit about the work that she's done with Harvard Business Review. If you're ready to make the most of your career, visit pathwise.io and become a member. Basic membership is free. You can also sign up on the website for the Pathwise newsletter and follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Career Sessions, Career Lessons. We hope the nuggets of wisdom shared today help guide your path to the successful career of your dreams. This podcast series is part of Pathwise.io, which is here to help you live the career you want. We provide a comprehensive mix of career and professional development events, insights, tools, and exercises backed by a group of leading coaches and other career management experts. If you aspire to something more or just something different in your career, join us at pathwise.io. You can find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. See you again on the next episode.